The Judiciary Committee will come to order. It's 1:32 on the afternoon of Friday, March 7th, 2012. We do not have a quorum to conduct business today. We do have myself here, Senator French, and Senator Coghill. I really want to thank Senator Coghill for being here today. I really, really appreciate that. We set these bills on for hearing some time ago. We have since that time lost a couple members to travel plans. I wanted to keep going forward because these are both important bills I wanted to hear. It would have been awfully embarrassing to be sitting up here alone. So, again, I really want to thank Senator Coghill. And I think the folks who are pushing the bills want to see that their bills get heard. But we do have the public watching, and neither bill is going to move today, as is our practice. We will have future hearings on them soon. But let's go ahead and get started. And we'll start with HB 80. We have a representative from Representative Newman's office here, Mr. Shattuck. Welcome to the committee. I understand your boss is out of town dealing with some family matters. We wish him well, but welcome to the committee.
Yes, sir. For the record, my name is Rex Shattuck, staff to Representative Mark Newman, who represents the lovely Upper Susitna Valley, as he would say. It is a beautiful place. He asked that I convey his regards and ask that you excuse him from this meeting. He does have some personal matters that he's addressing, and had to adjust his flights to take care of that.
We completely understand, and we're glad to have you here, Mr. Shattuck. Go ahead and make your presentation.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, thank you for the opportunity to present HB 80, clarifying legislation on the individual's right to self-defense. This bill on occasion has been referred to as the duty to retreat legislation. It probably would be more accurate to refer to it as no duty to retreat. There is no such thing as a simple piece of legislation. There are, however, simple additions we can do to existing statute that would clarify the intent of the legislature. It's the sponsor's intent that that's what this is about. It's to do that and clarify for the courts, criminals, and more importantly, in this case, the public. HB 80 does so by adding a one-liner to say, in any place where the person has a right to be. Alaska Statute 1181.335 is titled Justification, Use of Deadly Force in Defense of Self. By adding under Section B, subsection B, small b, a number 5, in any place where the person has a right to be, will clarify in Alaska statutes that the rights of an individual to defend themselves extend outside of their domain, the Castle Doctrine extension. When justified, this we're not changing any existing justifications in this legislation. We're just adding that you may protect yourself where you have a right to be. The present piece of legislation has come a long ways from its inception in the previous legislature. There have been many comments listened to by the sponsor, and we've adjusted the legislation to reflect that. It is a very simple statement at this particular point in time. There is lots of discussion that can be had on it, and I'm sure that will happen as the committee proceeds. But basically, in essence, the sponsor's belief is that Alaska statutes do not protect the rights of an individual to defend themselves. Prior to filing the legislation, the sponsor received a number of contacts from his constituents and people from around the state, as well as interest groups, on this particular issue. There are approximately 18 states plus that have passed this legislation or are working on it, and so we're very timely in our addressing this issue. We've asked several people to be available to assist the committee, as we will be as this bill passes through, and at that point, if there are any questions, sir, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Shattuck, for that overview. I will let Senator Coghill know that we have on the line to answer questions Lieutenant Dial from the State Troopers, Brian Judy from the NRA, he's well known here in these halls, Annie Carpinetti is in the room from the Department of Law, Quinlan Steiner is on the line also from the Public Defender Agency. So we've got a good, strong group of folks to help us walk our way through this. Let me ask whether any particular case or incident in Alaska brought this bill to, and I'll use your attention, meaning you and the bill sponsors, so I don't have to keep saying the bill sponsor, but I'll just ask, you know, whether it came to your office's attention.
I believe the sponsor would answer that there was no particular piece or event or case that actually brought this. However, that has it has been suggested that there have been one or two cases in recent history that might have inspired them. It suffices to say there has not been a particular case, but rather constituents and groups that have expressed an interest in addressing this legislation. It boils down to basically, if you will, several cases nationally, and that have raised the question about do you have a duty to retreat. The concept of duty to retreat perhaps goes back as far as to the Middle Ages, where there was a doctrine of retreat to the wall, if you will, and that was in an age when you had hand-to-hand combat, clubs, swords, and such such devices, and so it was practice for perhaps an army in the interests of preservation might retreat to a wall or the individual. There was a particular case where the judge overseeing that made an observation I think is valued to bring up here, and that was that in an age when you had hand-to-hand combat going on, basically it might be understood to have this retreat to the wall doctrine. However, in a day and age where you have weapons such as firearms, that concept is a little bit in folly when you think that it's not hand-to-hand, and whatever retreat you might try and take might be short-lived. You know, it's a much more appropriate time to look at that, and duty to retreat might not be so appropriate in these sorts of cases.
Thank you. You do have an impressive packet of supporting material and supporting messages from around the state. I know I've received very many of them. I read through the entire packet before I came down today. A lot of Alaskans are very interested in this. And we will be conducting, both in this hearing and a future one, sort of a detailed examination of self-defense law as it actually works on the ground. I think, to be fair, there is some misconception in the public about what the duty to retreat really means. I think a lot of people feel like they sort of have to give up in the face of a criminal attack, and that's not the case. Prosecutors are reasonable. The law is reasonable. The law doesn't expect you to have to walk away from a fight and to turn your back on a fight. And so I think some folks believe that they sort of don't have a right to defend themselves right now, which is not the case. Prosecutors, again, I say, are reasonable, and juries are reasonable. Juries are not going to impose criminal liability when a bad person is besetting another good person with violence. But we'll examine that in some great detail. Any questions from you, Senator?
No, right now.
Okay. Maybe we could turn to Ms. Carpinetti and get an overview of self-defense as it stands, and at least get that in front of the committee. Ms. Carpinetti, if you would mind coming forward. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Although I don't have anything prepared for you today, I guess the first thing I would say is that self-defense is a defense, which the state has to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt.
Let's just walk through how that actually works in the world, because even that statement I think is going to befuddle a lot of listeners. They're like, what does that mean? Let's just say we have we'll use a grocery store parking lot case where a innocent a mother of two is walking her groceries out to the car after a long day at work, and she's beset by a robber in the parking lot. She decides to shoot the robber because she believes he has a gun. She has a gun in her purse, and the case now comes to the DAs. The DAs have to do what? They have to screen that case and look to see if they're going to accept the charge of, you know, homicide against the mother. Is that right?
That's correct. And the screening decision in your example would be not to prosecute that woman, because in our state, the duty to retreat only applies when a person knows that he or she can retreat in complete safety to him or herself and to others that they're protecting black children.
So in my little, you know, quick hypothetical, and we'll probably expand on that some more, in my quick hypothetical, your office's decision would be no prosecution because no crime had occurred. That was a lawful use of self-defense.
That's correct.
And that's under current state of Alaska law.
Yes, sir.
Great. And if the woman going to her car was unarmed and Senator Coghill was there loading groceries in the back of his car and he saw this happening, he happened to have a gun, would he be authorized to shoot and kill the attacker, assuming that he saw a gun in the attacker's hands?
Through the chair, if he had reasonable belief that that woman was in danger, he could use deadly force to protect her and her children. And he would not have to retreat under those circumstances.
And the duty to retreat pertains not so much in this case to Senator Coghill, but as to the victim. Is that right? The question is whether she can get away with complete and total safety. Is that right?
In that example, yes, because unless in your example, Senator Coghill was also in danger.
No. We'll keep the gun trained on that. We'll keep the bad guy's gun trained on the woman who's carrying her groceries out to the car. He sees this happening, and he in a split second decides that he's got to do something to protect her. And the issue is not whether he can hop in his car and get away. The issue is whether she is whether she can get away with complete safety.
That's correct.
That's the way I read it. Right now says, the law says right now, a person may not use deadly force under this section if the person knows that with complete personal safety and with complete safety as to others being defended, the person can avoid the necessity. So that's the way the law stands right now. And so the duty to retreat, now if Senator Coghill, now you have to start sort of fiddling with the hypothetical, right? If Senator Coghill, for example, the woman is walking out of the grocery store with her bags, and her car is parked next to the store. And 20 yards away, there's a car, and a guy gets out of it with a gun. And we don't know what he's going to do. He's just gotten out of the car with a gun, and you know, there's a woman, you know, 20 yards away. You know, what then?
You
sort of have to analyze the situation, right?
Every situation is different, and you have to analyze it on its facts. But if Senator Coghill had the reasonable belief that there was serious danger to that woman, deadly danger, he would have the right to use the defense of third parties, of defense of others, and he would not have the duty to retreat under those circumstances.
Shattuck, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Ms. Carpinetti is exactly right in what she's saying. I think the sponsor's thought on that was, being that there's objective and subjective that has to be looked at. Justification is objective. Subjective is a little bit different. I think it was Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes who made the comment that when it came to the subjective, perhaps one of the things that should be considered is it reasonable to expect a person to be distracted at that point to make that subjective decision as to whether they have a right to actually react, as opposed to knowing there's justification, which is objective, and being able to act to defend themselves, the subjective being a little bit more. If you've got a gun in your face, how subjective, you know, do you need to be? And that was from a Supreme Court justice, if I remember, back in 1921.
I did some research on this question before I came down as well, Mr. Shattuck, and you're right. It was Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes who said that there's no duty to retreat under certain circumstances, obviously, when you're being beset. He said detached reflection cannot be demanded in the presence of an uplifted knife. And I think that's common sense. That's the way the law stands right now in the state of Alaska. That we don't expect Senator Coghill to sort of go through a calculated, you know, sort of slow motion analysis of the whole situation. You know, if he sees someone being beset by an armed robber, he can kill that robber. And the Department of Law is going to say, you know, good riddance. Frankly, you know, it's what's going to happen. They might not issue a press release to that effect, but they're not going to prosecute Senator Coghill or anybody else. And if they were so misguided as to do so, Senator Coghill would walk in with what legal advantage? He would walk into court with the legal advantage of the state having the burden of not only convicting him beyond a reasonable doubt, but disproving his self-defense claim beyond a reasonable doubt. That is, there's two hoops they have to jump over as the law stands right now. And I guess the reason why we're going through this at some length is that I totally appreciate the desire of the people of the state of Alaska to have this bill passed. You know, it's a very strong impulse, and the bill is going to lead this committee. But I think there has just been some, and people thinking this through, they just get the feeling that they're somehow right now kept from exercising that right of self-defense. And again, the prosecutors in this state do not want to send innocent people to jail. They want people to protect themselves. They recognize that this is a state that doesn't have a lot of police officers in it. And so I just think, you know, anyone who's watching this should not go home thinking, I got to wait if I'm in the, you know, grocery store parking lot tonight because, you know, someone's going to come get me. You have an absolute right to defend yourself. Further questions on this point? Ms. Carpinetti, thank you so much. We do have a couple other folks on the line. Let me maybe turn to Brian Judy from the NRA. I know he's been working on this bill quite assiduously for several years. Mr. Judy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This is Brian Judy. I am the Alaska State Liaison for the National Rifle Association. We are in strong support of House Bill 80. And I just wanted to say that I spoke with the sponsor of the bill, and what the sponsor's office suggested was that since there's not a quorum, that I withhold my testimony until what I understand will be a follow-up hearing on this bill, and you know, where there will be a full committee and the sponsor will be there and offer my testimony at that point in time. So I guess at the sponsor's suggestion, I will plan to do that, but I would be happy, you know, if questions come up in the course of the discussion today to perhaps weigh in and answer any questions that come to me.
Sure, that seems fair. We're going to have another presentation on the bill, I think a week and 2 days from now, and we'll be hearing from a state prosecutor who's got some qualms about the bill, and I think it's fair to let you and others weigh in at that time, although the time will be a little more constricted at that moment. They'll probably be keeping into a three-minute testimony. So if you have any comment about what you've heard so far today, this would be a good time to express it, and maybe I can ask whether the NRA has any sort of good examples out there of what I would call an innocent person being prosecuted for homicide when the duty to retreat or a bill like this would have prevented that prosecution from going forward.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as the sponsor indicated, this bill was not brought based on any specific circumstances. It's brought more on the philosophical discussion that's taking place around the country on the issue of self-defense. And in fact, there are now 27 states that do have this legislation in place, either through the actual passage of legislation or through case law or in a couple circumstances, jury instructions. So Alaska's not breaking any new ground here. Over half the states already have adopted this. And many other states have laws that are along the lines of Alaska, and the existing Alaska law does already provide that there is no duty to retreat if the person is justified, and that's an important point to make, though the person must be justified in using deadly force. But if a person's justified and they're on premises that they own, they lease, where they reside, or in a building where they work, you know, a vast array of locations, there already is no duty to retreat. And it's the position of the National Rifle Association that if a person is somewhere else out in public where they have a legal right to be, you know, maybe they're in that grocery store parking lot, then they're justified. And justification is fairly complicated and all-encompassing in these Alaska statutes. So if you are justified, then you shouldn't have to go through that mental calculation or that mental exercise that's been alluded to, I think, here, as to whether you can retreat with complete safety. So, Mr. Chairman, you mentioned that to people listening in that you do have an absolute right to defend yourself under the existing law. And there is a caveat. If you're out in public you don't necessarily have an absolute right. You have to, and I realize, you know, that detached reflection is somewhat difficult in the circumstance where there's an uplifted knife or a pointed gun, and I think that would be pretty clear, but, you know, in other cases it might not be so clear, and the person's purse, you know, they're going to, at some point, the prosecutor and perhaps the jury is going to, you know, determine if they were justified. So they're going to have to determine in their mind that they are justified. And then once they've made that calculation, then subsequently, they need to determine if they can retreat with complete safety. So there are those two factors that are going to be considered by the prosecutor and going to be considered by the jury. So they have to be considered, essentially, by the person who's in that circumstance deciding whether to employ deadly force. So I think we need to be careful about, you know, the suggestion that there's an absolute right to defend yourself, because there are those two considerations, primary and most significant consideration being justification, and the secondary consideration being retreat.
Thank you for that. And let me ask, while you're on the line, has the NRA done any analysis of the idea of, because the exception is now is for any place where a person has a right to be. And I'm, what does that really mean? When I go to Disneyland, do I have a right to be in Disneyland, or am I there at the permission of the Walt Disney Corporation? And when I go to the movies, do I have a right to be in the movie house, or am I there with the permission of the owners, sort of the implied permission and as a guest? What light can you shed on that legal question?
Mr. Chairman, I would say that if you're not trespassing, you have a legal right to be there. If you're in Disneyland and you've paid your money to enter that location, then you have a legal right to be there. Now obviously, private property owners have the ability to impose certain limitations on the use of their property. And you get into a perhaps a more complicated question when you differentiate between private property that's closed to the public and private property that is open to the public. If you want to restrict people coming into your house, you pretty much have complete authority, you know, based on whether or not they have a firearm, whether or not you believe in their religious beliefs, their color of their skin, or whatever. You know, you can prevent somebody from coming into your home, but a person operating in whatever entity it is that's open to the public doesn't have those, you know, the same amount of authority, I would say, as you would on your private property close to the public. So I think that, you know, the bottom line is the NRA's analysis is that if you're not trespassing and you have the legal ability to be in a place lawfully, then that is what would be covered under the provisions of House Bill 80.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I don't know if we've given it much thought, but it's on my mind today about, you know, do I have a right to be in a movie house, or am I there with permission, you know, kind of sort of demand admission? You know, my First Amendment rights sort of aren't too dependent upon someone else's permission. I don't know if this is the same sort of right to be concept as that or something else. Last question, and this may be more for back to Ms. Carpinetti or maybe Mr. Steiner, but if we were to pass this law, where would the duty to retreat be? That is, are we essentially removing the duty to retreat from Alaska state law through the passage of this bill? Because it strikes me that we're going awfully close to that. You know, most people have a right to be 99% of the places where they are, I think, at least in the common way of thinking. Mr. Steiner, maybe we haven't heard from you yet. Maybe put yourself on the record and give me your view of that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm public defender for the state of Alaska. I mean, in response to that specific question, I think if the bill were to pass and you didn't have a duty to retreat where you had a legal right to be, you would have a remaining duty to retreat in places where you didn't have a right to be. If you were trespassing, for instance, would be an example where a duty to retreat would remain under the statute.
Could you say that again?
Well, if you were in a place that you didn't have a legal right to be, for instance, if you were trespassing on somebody else's land and it was clear you were trespassing, and then a situation arose where you were presented with the circumstances that might justify the use of deadly force, the duty to retreat would remain under those circumstances.
Well, how about, for example, a parking lot that's closed to the public at night? It's posted, you know, a parking lot closed from 10 p.m. To 6 a.m., and you're there in the parking lot. You don't have a legal right to be there. There's no one that's shooing you off, but there, it's posted. You may not have seen the sign, but there you are in this parking lot. Would you agree that person probably doesn't have a legal right to be there?
I would agree that's probably true, and if someone were charged under those circumstances, there would probably be litigation about whether or not they had a duty to retreat.
The first question you try to resolve is, did they have a legal right to be there? Once you establish that question, you now know whether or not they had a duty to retreat.
Right. And one of the earlier questions, you know, you're dealing with a case, obviously, where somebody has used deadly force. So the preliminary question is, do you even have the authority to use deadly force in the first place? And that's where I think this bill sort of may have no impact at all, meaning, you know, they're mutually exclusive events, theoretically, under the statute. If you can retreat in total safety, you really don't have the authority to use deadly force in the first place. If you have the authority to use deadly force, arguably there's no circumstances under which you could retreat in complete and total safety. Because the authority to use deadly force is, you know, a reasonable fear of physical force, that could cause serious physical injury.
Arguably,
they're mutually exclusive, and the duty to retreat under one particular view doesn't really have a whole lot of effect. And so removing it because you're in a place where you have a legal right to be isn't going to change really the nature of people's rights, nor the litigation involved in these cases.
Does the Public Defender Agency, do you have a position on the bill?
We don't have a position on the bill.
Senator Coghill, question?
No, this is going to be a general comment because I appreciate some of the questions that have gone before. There's kind of two ways that I'm looking at this as we move forward. The statutes, no doubt, are going to be handled with the legal question before a court of law, before the court with lawyers arguing kind of the fine points. But the statute's also written for the general population. And I think, the court might look with complete public safety in one way first reading on my part, my first thought was, I'm always going to have to retreat no matter what. And so when it gets to the court, that's one question. But when it gets to the public, the question really is, where's my rights? Here I have people who want to do bad things. I go to the statutes to find out what right do I have. And so I'm looking at it from not only the court's perspective and how you would apply the rule of law in a court of law, but what does a statute mean to a general population when they're looking at it? And I can see why this would clarify just a general reading of the law. But I can also see where you get into the fine point. It's really redundancy in many ways. Anyway, I just wanted to bring that up as a comment because in the Judiciary Committee, we noodle down into the real fine points of law, how it's actually played out in the court. But the statutes are also written for the general population.
Fair comment, no question. And people will look to the law for direction, and so I agree that's it's got to be as clear as possible for folks in this important area. We have spoken to most of the witnesses online. We don't have anyone signed to testify besides these folks, and so I will see if anyone has any concluding remarks. Mr. Shattuck, do you want to make any wrap-up remarks before we set the bill aside?
Rick Shattuck, staff representative Mark Newman. No other than to say, I'm sure that we'll be available to do anything we can to help answer any questions along with anybody else. and we appreciate your hearing. And they were some good questions, and I will make sure that President has a copy of those questions so we can answer them.
Great. Thanks so much. I appreciate it. So let's go ahead and set this bill aside for the time being. As I said, we don't have a quorum. We couldn't move it if we wanted to. That brings us next to Senate Bill 134. And we have a representative from Senator Kukesh's office here. Welcome to the committee. And a few folks signed up to testify, but go ahead and put yourself on the record. Shakely, nice to see you. And we'll go from there.
Okay, thank you, and good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and member of the committee. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 134, an act relating to child support award, repealing Rule 90.3, Alaska Rule of Civil Procedure, and providing for an effective date. The bill basically puts the child support 90.3 rule into statute and changes the calculation formula from the current percentage approach that only takes into account the non-custodial parent's income to an income shared model that considers both parents' income. And there were a couple of other small changes, minor changes, that we took out of the rule, and that was the section where it said where it was appropriate circumstances to charge the grandparent for child support, so we took that out. And then there was a section on forms, we took that out, as well as the commentary, we took that out as well. So just for your information. And the bill came about when I followed the child support review process under Rule 90.3 in 2008. I was disappointed in the process because people did not have the opportunity to speak to people who have the power to make changes. And at the statewide hearing, I asked how we can change this and was told by attorney who was a member of the two review committees to put it into statute. So 3 years ago, we introduced a bill, but it didn't get through the process, so we're introducing it again. And our office receives quite a few calls from people who don't mind paying child support but are having problems with the system and feel they aren't being listened to or treated fair. And pretty much the bottom line for the bill is to give people a voice and to be fair to the children especially.
Sure. We do have any questions for the bill sponsor?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Cockhill.
I'll ask the question, but it looks like there might be a lot of public members. There was two issues that I like about the approach here, but one of them I wasn't involved or understand the makeup of sharing of the burden of child support based on the income. So whoever is going to answer that, I don't know if it's a sponsor or somebody publicly testifying. And then one of the things that I've worked on down through the years is how to get non-monetary issues involved with child support.
Like visitation or?
No. For example, there are some places in Alaska where somebody might be able to share the efforts of hunting and fishing, things like that, that maybe could get some value. So since the issue came up, I just wanted to throw that out to a sponsor. We don't need the answer right now, but the valuation issue on using the two incomes was kind of important to me on how you came up with that. So I don't know if it's a technical matter that CSED is going to come up with or if it's the sponsor.
We do have a raft of folks available to answer questions, including Nancy Mead from the court system and John Maloney, Carol Beecher from CSSD, as well as Stacy Steinberg from the AG's office. And then we've got three members of the public who want to testify.
So I'll listen up first, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Let's turn to the public first, and we'll get that on the record and then ask some of the witnesses what their view is. Thank you for the overview of the bill. Let's turn to Daisy Stevens. Daisy Stevens, are you there?
This is Dixie Banner.
Oh, Dixie Banner. I was looking for, wait 1 second, Dixie. Daisy Stevens, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the committee. Give us your name and your affiliation, if any, and go ahead and give us your testimony.
My name is Daisy Stevens. I'm from Fairbanks. I'd like to thank you for giving me this opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 134. I've always felt... I'm kind of nervous.
That's okay.
I've always felt that it was unfair for child support to be paid by only one parent. I have quite a few nightmare stories that I can share with you that involves how unfair the child support services have been toward the paying parent. I know that because of confidentiality, I am limited on what I can say. However, there are two stories that I would like to share with you. One of my sons asked for a review on his case because last year alone he paid over $20,000 back pay. He was told a flat-out no. The only one that can ask for a review is the mother. He was also told he still owes $32,000 back pay because of interest. As a result, he cannot support the family he has now. And so his family and the family he has now and himself have to live with me. Excuse me. My other son is being charged child support, although his daughter lives with him. He has had his daughter since she was 2 years old when we found out the mother was in jail and her parents didn't let us know. The mother, at one time, was receiving child support while she was in jail. We've been waiting for a judge in Fairbanks to sign papers to give him the full physical and custodial rights to his daughter for several years now. NANA, the regional corporation, will not give him his daughter's corporation checks because he does not have that paperwork. As a result, her mother gets those checks. And again, my granddaughter is left out without the support and educational monies that could be saved for her to use in the future. When the judge sends a letter to the parent, the corporation has to have that word custodial in there for them to receive corporation monies for their kids. So I am in full support of changing Senate Bill 134 to include the incomes of both parents. And these are just two little stories. I'm sure there's a lot more out there, and I myself have a lot more, too. But I would just like to thank you for letting me testify today. And again, I am in full support of changing this bill. Thank you for your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Ms. Stevens. We appreciate you coming out. Let's turn now to Dixie Banner. Dixie, if you're there, go ahead and give us your name and affiliation, if any. And we'll hear your testimony.
I'm Dixie Banner from Osceola. I'm a mother of two boys that are off the system. I'm a veteran and a citizen of Alaska. I've gone through exactly what she's going through, and I've been on both sides of the street, and because I had a job and he didn't, I lost custody. I had to fight and fight. I have books and stacks of motions in the court that could fill a room. And I've been in the same situation as she has. And I've been penalized because I was a non-custodial parent and treated like worthless because I had no custody because I couldn't get along with the individual. Well, i.e., he was a hell's angel. And the various judges that we've had to deal with would not change the court order because they didn't want, because for every $2 that they collect, $1 goes back to you guys for the state funding. And I've done research on this for my papers and my master's program. And bottom line comes down to is the kids lose. and they ended up, the IG only forced him to pay $50 because he's, quote, a disabled vet. But yet he always seemed to have money and pilfered through my house and various other things. But because it's a civil matter, I can never possibly have him prosecuted. I've been through the same thing as she has, but she's a grandparent. I'm going to be a grandparent, hopefully not for another 10 years. However, I have informed my kids exactly what the program is like, and they know what the program is like, and it's very discouraging. And that's the reason why you have so much domestic violence in the state of Alaska. And I've talked to Wendy Lyford, Kathy Gildas, you name it, and I'm not impressed. But I am now glad that I'm out of the system. But bottom line, it takes two parents to have a child, and it takes two kids, two parents to raise a child. And I ended up losing a lot of income, a lot of time, stress, and everything that you can imagine to raise those boys. But they are now two U.S. corpsmen in the United States Navy, and I'm very proud of them, but they know what their dad's all about. But it didn't have to happen this way if the state would have taken responsibility. It's very emotional, and I understand where she's coming from. If you had kids and grandkids, you go through the system, you would understand. But because the judges, they ended up in their own little courtroom, they don't have to live that way. It comes Christmas time, and when you're trying to have Christmas and you have constant interference because you're not getting child support, or B, you're not paying it. And this, and the APD and the troopers have nightmares over this mess. Do you understand where I'm coming from?
You made a good statement. Thank you.
But I'll tell you, we have to take care of our kids, and the system is broken. And if you don't take care of the kids now, we're going to have a very socialistic process, and the state's going to end up taking care of the community. And that's not what we were supposed to do. We're supposed to get an education, raise our kids, and become parents. We don't need the state's interference.
Ms. Banner, thank you so much for coming out and making the statement. We also have Michelle Bayless on the line. Michelle Bayless, are you there?
I am.
Welcome to the committee. Give us your name and affiliation, if any, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Okay. I'm Michelle Bayless. I'm a single parent of two boys. I've been a single parent for over 10 years, and I don't know if my comments will be in support of this bill or not, because I just haven't had time to really review it, but I can sympathize with both what the other two speakers have talked about, and, you know, struggling at Christmas to buy the gifts because you're the only one buying the gifts. The non-custodial parent only has to pay his minimum amount of child support, and so I wrote something up so I wouldn't ramble on, and I'll read through it, and hopefully it will make sense. As I said, I've been a single parent for over 10 years. I've always been a primary custodial parent. My concerns or issues with child support may or may not be addressed by this bill, and I truly hope I'm not wasting anyone's time. My first issue is that the non-custodial parent has only paid the minimum amount required by the court when the custody was established years ago, and at times has not paid at all. The last I checked, he owed over $10,000 in arrears. Our oldest child is now a freshman in college this year and needs our financial help. His father has refused to provide that financial help, and that puts a strain on my budget because he needs to be in school and he needs our help. So I have to find that money somewhere, somehow, and other things go unpaid. His dad also refuses to provide income information for my son to use in a FAFSA application, which means his income isn't included, which means he can't get more a sufficient amount of student loans to cover his tuition. The court doesn't require that the non-custodial parent or the parents be responsible for their children if they're in college, and I really hope that that part changes, because even though your kids are in college, you're still helping them, and we still want them to succeed and be productive citizens of our state and country. My third issue is the non-custodial parent has not provided birthday gifts or Christmas gifts to her children. This isn't a huge issue, but it goes to point to the fact that even though he's paying child support, it doesn't cover all of the expenses that are involved in raising kids. And it would help if there was either more money or more involvement. And the non-custodial parent has not been involved in their school or sports activities, has not been involved in graduation ceremonies or games. And these burdens come on to the custodial parent, where I am making up for his lack of being there. either by rearranging my schedule, canceling work, taking off early to get them to a game or practice. All of these things have happened over the years, and I've done it, and I'm happy to say I've done it. But the system is not set up to help the kids in this situation. It's just who, basically, what parent gets the best deal, and it's the kids that end up coming up short because I can't do everything. The non-custodial parent has not helped keep our home in good condition. That burdens come on to me completely. His child support payments do not cover the repair of a roof or the things that are needed to keep our home safe, and the same thing with vehicles. I've taught both of our kids to drive, and that has come with some consequences with teenage drivers. He doesn't provide any of the help for that, or the cost of repairs or insurance to, you know, make sure our vehicles and the kids are properly insured as new young drivers. And I am happy to say that I've been able to work myself into a way and educate myself in a way that I can afford to do these things. It makes it tight. I do have to sacrifice things, but if this bill will help with that, then I fully support it. And I realize that these things may be considered personal choices of the father to not be involved. But I would like to make a point that when I do receive child support, it does help. It doesn't cover all of the costs needed to provide for them. And I know, I think I'm starting to repeat myself now, so I guess that's all I have to say. If this bill will help improve the quality of life for kids, then I fully support it. But if it takes away from a full-time custodial parent and makes that burden harder, then I can't say that I support that.
Ms. Bayless, thanks so much for coming up to testify.
Thank you.
One question for you, Ms. Shockley. The Section 4 and 5, the repealer of Rule 90.3, this bill would put 90.3 into statute, and Section 5, the non-applicability of a two-thirds vote requirement. I have not shipped that question off to Ledge Legal. Have you shipped that question off to Ledge Legal to see what they think about that?
Yes.
And what do they say?
What's there is correct. In fact, they drafted the bill, but they also talked with Nancy, I believe, law or courts.
Ms. Mead? Nancy Mead?
Stacy, I'm sorry, Stacy Steinberg.
Okay. We'll talk to both of them. Yeah, okay. We'll talk to them about that. And so let's go ahead and do that now. Let's start with the court system, because I have a couple questions about how we currently handle changes of 90.3, and then we'll turn to Ms. Steinberg about the drafting of the bill, and then finally the folks from CSSD. Nancy Mead, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Put yourself on the record.
Hello, my name is Nancy Mead. I am general counsel for the Alaska court system, and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have for me.
Let's start with the substantive question of how changes to 90.3 are handled now. What I hear from the bill sponsor, not so much from the public, I think the public's just unhappy with child support sort of orders in general, and I hope we never get in a position of having to change those orders because they're intensely difficult questions. But there is some sort of concern about whether the public has the opportunity to influence the crafting of court rules that have a huge impact on the lives of many members of the public. How can a member of the public get their ideas heard by the Court Rules Committee? Tell us how the court rules crafted and so forth.
Okay, this rule is a little bit different from almost every other court rule, so I'll talk about this one.
Good, thanks.
There is a committee that is constituted every 4 years that's required by the Code of Federal Regulations. Each state has to review its guidelines every 4 years to be in compliance and receive funding from the federal government. The state does that, of course, through the court system because it's a court rule. So the way that works is for about 18 months prior to the date a change needs to be made, prior to the four-year deadline, a committee meets, and the Supreme Court appoints the committee. There's one currently, right now, ongoing. It It is made up of two judges of the Superior Court and six volunteer attorneys from the community whose names were recommended by judges and others as being folks active with family law and knowledgeable about how the rule works. Stacey Steinberg, who's on the line, is also on the committee because she knows very much about how the rule works. So this committee meets throughout, say, 18 months to review and consider whether the rule is still resulting in awards that are fair and appropriate for children. The committee solicits and, in fact, receives a lot of public input. At the beginning of the process, notices are put in, I think, 32 newspapers across the country saying the court system is about to look at this rule.
Just for the record, country or state?
State
okay.
of Alaska.
That's okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very good.
And
We listen to the questions.
Yes. And in addition, signs are put up in every courthouse. Advertisements are put out. Then public comment is received as a result of those. And if I'm not mistaken, in this past round, over 100 comments were received by the committee to consider and read. The committee then works up the rule, reads every one of the comments and considers what to do with it, and comes up with a recommended change to the court rule, at which point that is circulated again and notices are put once again in 30-some newspapers across the state of Alaska, and comment is again solicited and received. And I think this time there were almost 300 comments received. Each one is copied for every member of the committee and distributed in a notebook. Everyone reviews them and sits and has several full-day 9-to-5 meetings to review those comments and decide what changes they would require in the rule. So those are the two ways that the public can and does submit written comments about the rule. In addition, there's an oral public testimony received on this, unique among all court rules. We go to the LIOs around the state and advertise that anybody who wants to testify orally about the proposed changes to the rule can do so.
So it's like a bill hearing where you can either come show up in public and sort of meet the committee, or you can testify telephonically, I take it, and call in from another LI to the one where the hearing's being held?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And people do call in, and some people do appear. So that's what happens every 4 years. In addition, any other time, the court rules attorney, which is my former position, hears suggestions from anybody all the time, email, phone call, whatever, about any change to a court rule. So this is a scheduled review that occurs every 4 years, but any other time somebody makes a suggestion for a change, that can be considered by the rules attorney, brought to the Standing Committee on Family Rules, and then could eventually go to the Supreme Court.
And let's just imagine that this group of eight, two Superior Court judges, six other members, decide to change, and maybe they decide to change to the income shares model instead of the one we've been using. It seems like the majority of states go income shares. Would their proposal then be reviewed by the Supreme Court, or do they have the authority to simply promulgate it?
It absolutely must be promulgated by the Supreme Court. Rule changes are adopted by the court, not by committees ever. So the committee, after it finishes receiving public input and reviewing any changes, it's deciding upon, prepares a report for the Supreme Court, a report of recommended changes, and then the rules attorney, as the intermediary, I suppose, between the committee and the court, meets with the court to present the report and any and all background information. And in fact, it's a meeting with the five members of the Supreme Court where several notebooks of information are presented, including every one of the public comments. And the Supreme Court in that meeting decides, or more honestly, series of meetings, because it's a complicated issue, decides what to do with the rule, whether to accept the recommendations, whether to do something else. And I will add that in the last review, the idea of adopting the income shares model rather than the percentage of income approach was asked of the Supreme Court. The committee had, of course, heard that this might be a possibility, and really, as a practical matter, before investing a lot of time in drafting a different rule, asked the Supreme Court for interim guidance, and the suggestion was to stick with the percentage of income approach so that the committee didn't do unnecessary work. So that was the direction, and that is the approach that the rule currently has.
It's interesting. So let me make sure I understand. The committee went first to the Supreme Court to say basically what level of interest might you have in an income shares approach before we do, you know, 18 months of sort of drafting. And the Supreme Court said not much. And so that the matter dropped there.
Yes, although it was more than
just... I'm oversimplifying.
Yes. Right. I mean, the request for guidance of the Supreme Court was, as I say, a practical step, and it was accompanied by a notebook of thoughts on the income shares versus percentage of income approach and whether one of them results in something that's more or less fair. And, of course, the ultimate question is fair to whom? If the primary custodian, and that's, I think, the situation that we're usually talking about, even though the presumption in divorce is shared custody. The court starts with the presumption that it's 50-50 father-mother, but many end up with primary custody, and I think that's what people are thinking of, sort of the scenario of single mothers that you think of. And, of course, with that scenario, it's very often the custodial parent, perhaps the mother, who feels that the awards are too low and it would be more fair to have higher amounts awarded. And in that same situation, it's very often the father who feels the awards are too high and it would be more fair to have him or that non-custodial parent pay less. And there is, I guess the question is whether there's empirical evidence that one is more fair. It's going to favor one party or the other, whether you go up or down.
Right. I am glad you brought that nuance to my attention. The percentage of income model, the one we use, says that only in cases where primary custody is in one person, you know, where primary custody resides in one parent, do you base a support amount only on the income of the other parent. And that's only where one parent has 70% of custody or more. So in a 50-50 custody sharing agreement, in the typical custody sharing agreement, does the court use a percentage of income method then?
Well, it's still called percentage of income, but what
does it amount to income shares?
Well, let me tell you what actually happens.
Okay,
so if you have a divorce and they have 50-50 custody of the children, which is, again, the presumption, I won't go so far as to say what's typical because I don't know if in non-intact families, very often the one parent is missing or doesn't want custody or something like that. But if you start with 50-50 shared custody, what the current rule would call for is a calculation of what it would be if dad had custody, what it would be if mom had, and then you do an offset. So in those situations, or divided custody where one child is with one parent, one's with the other, and hybrid, there are different situations. But generally, you take one parent's and you do the calculation, you take the other's and you do the calculation, then whoever has more income is going to be the higher calculation, half of the higher number. That person has to pay the other mother, or the other parent. So in shared custody, divided and hybrid, it's both parents calculated offset by the percentage of time they have the child. But yes, in primary, if somebody makes $1,000 a month, but, and I'll just use as an example, he does not have custody of the kids or has custody less than 30%, the current rule would have you just take 20%, if there's one child, of the $1,200 he pays her. And that's based on the presumption that the person with custody spends money on the child, and so only the non-custodial parent in that with primary custody is required to make monetary payments.
Well, this may be why we've stayed out of this.
Did I muddy it up? I'm sorry.
I just want to run away. No.
No, I didn't. I didn't intend to make it more confusing.
It is confusing.
I could explain more if it would help.
Yeah. More questions for Ms. Mead. Actually, I was really interested in sort of the overview, mainly of how the process works as far as public input. It sounds like there's ample public input into the rule, I think there's ample public input.
It might be interesting to ask what was the balance of discussion on on two different methods of figuring it. I mean, it was said that the percentage of income was more fair. It'd be interesting to know what was the balance of discussion on why it's more fair over against taking the two different income models.
I believe you're referring to Ms. Shockley's comment that it's more fair.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't know which is more fair. If you change the amount, it's going to be more fair to the party who gets more and less fair to the party. It's hard for me to answer that question as to which results in more fair, but I will say that it hasn't been shown. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, the question was when the court had considered from the committee a different style of figuring, the court came back and said, we think that this percentage income seems to be more fair. And I was wondering what the balance of their thought was on, you know, the calculation fairness.
Okay, through the chair, Senator Coghill, I wouldn't say that the court concluded that the percentage of income was more fair. And I think all I can say about the court's conclusion is that they concluded that the current percentage of income approach did result in child support awards that were appropriate.
Okay. And all right. I misunderstood you then. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mead. Thank you so much for being here. Very helpful testimony.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to John Maloney, Carol Beecher, and Stacy Steinberg, all on the line to answer questions. Maybe Mr. Maloney will kind of make you the lead agent here. Go ahead and put yourself on the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is John Maloney. I'm the director of the Child Support Services Division. And I would be more than happy to attempt to answer any of the questions you might have.
Let's start with some basics. How many child support orders are there in Alaska, or if you don't know how many there are in Alaska, how many of them fall under your jurisdiction? That is, how many child support awards are you monitoring, so to speak?
Right now, we have active about 48,000 cases.
And is that the total number, or is that the number that you have kind of in your orbit?
That's the total that we actually are actively involved in. There are other child support orders out there that are issued by the court that are basically have not come to us for enforcement of any type.
And so maybe tell us what is it about a child support order, what is it about a family situation that leads them to your department? Why would a child support order be sort of under your jurisdiction versus one that's not?
Mr. Chairman, basically, we end up with child support from two different methods. One is through the court. We may be asked by one of the parties to a court order to enforce that court order. Also, the parties may come to us directly and ask us to do anything from establish paternity to establish a support order to enforce a support order. All of those items we can and do administratively.
Okay, and have you had a chance to look at SB 134?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I have, and we've run a number of calculations on SB 134.
Tell me about them.
Mr. Chairman, the thing that we've noticed in running calculations on SB 134, and as Mead sort of pointed out, it's hard to say what's more fair about either this approach or the approach that we currently use. What we have found that up to a combined income level of about $31,000, $32,000, the method employed by SB 134 tends to result in a higher order for the non-custodial parent to pay than it does under Civil Rule 90.3. Once we pass that $31,000, $32,000 combined income category, the opposite seems to take place. It's more apparent that at those higher levels, SB 134 actually results in the individual paying less than they would pay under 90.3.
Hold on. I want to make sure I understand that because this is important. You're saying the way the law is, if this bill passed, if the combined family income is less than $32,000, more money would go from the non-custodial to the custodial.
That's correct.
Okay, I just need to write this down because I'll forget this in a week or so. So I got to write this down right now. More to custodial. And above that amount, it'd be the other way around. You'd get less money to the custodial parent.
Correct.
Okay, so that's one.
I can't say that that's positive in every case because there are three variables here, and you can vary those differently. So it's very hard to say under every situation. But the ones that we've done, basic samples of, that's what we found.
And have you done any analysis about what would happen to current awards should this bill pass?
If this bill passes, one of the things that it immediately does, and that's why there's a substantial fiscal note attached to the bill, one of the things it does is it makes every child support order basically in the state of Alaska subject to modification, because it is considered a material change of circumstance.
So it would be a good time for me to open up my family law practice.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, that would be correct.
That's a joke. For the public, that's a joke. It's a joke.
We estimate somewhere in excess of 20,000 of the orders would be subject to modification. And if, in fact, even 50% of those applied, we would have 10,000 orders that we would have to modify within 180 days, 6 months.
And tell me about right now, how many orders can you process, per month? That is, how many can you sort of institute, modify? I mean, how much time is it? I know there's a wide variety, but just roughly, what's your workload per month?
Roughly right now, with a staff of 14 people that handle modifications, and that's modifications alone, we do approximately 3,000 modifications in a year's time.
3,000 in a year. So this would create 7 years of work for you?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. That's why in the fiscal note we've asked for 24 temporary positions and 5 permanent positions to handle both the modifications and the increased time that it takes to process. Even though the calculation itself is not difficult, the change in calculation is not difficult, we now end up having to obtain information from two different parties. This, by its nature, will slow down the process somewhat and probably require that we have a small additional staff.
And that's all on the fiscal note, I take it?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it is.
Thank you. And would this change also make any difference in how you go about meeting the applicable federal guidelines that deal with child support and so forth?
Mr. Chairman, no, it wouldn't. This actually meets the requirements of federal law as far as what the guidelines have to do. As Ms. Shockley has mentioned, a number of other states do it this way. It really doesn't change that, and it doesn't change any position that we have as far as what we have to do to meet the federal requirements. It simply gives us more of an opportunity to meet those requirements because we're going to have those additional requirements to do this huge number of modifications.
Thank you. Mr. Mowley, those are all the questions I have. Senator Coghill.
Yeah, one of the questions that comes to mind in listening to the public testimony and over against this change, it sounds like the accountability issue is one of the issues. So help me with your process. If there is a support awarded to the custodial parent and they are not actually physically handling that child, but the non-custodial actually has them, how do you enter into that discussion to kind of reset that fairness?
through the chair to Senator Coghill. This comes about in two different, I have to give you two different answers. One is, if the order is an order that was established administratively by us, we can, in fact, change that order as the individuals change custody, because we look at it simply from the fact that who has the actual physical custody of the child. If that order was produced in court, then it has to go back to court for custody to be changed, because court has already set that specifically. And we, as the agency, cannot change that.
And what is the general, on the ones that you can handle, what is the general timing of some of those things? It seems to me like that's one of the big rubs in this whole thing, is getting the kind of the either the courts or the bureaucratic action.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, we can make that happen in an administrative order in a reasonable period of time. It should not take more than 30 or 45 days to get that done. As far as going to court, that takes a longer period of time for the individuals to get into court and to get custody changed and to get a new order out of the court. And I really can't speak to how long that would take.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Maloney, thank you. I think we have a couple questions for Stacy Steinberg. Are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead and put yourself on the record.
Thank you. This is Stacy Steinberg. I work for the Attorney General's Office, and I'm the Section Chief for the Collections and Support Section, and that's the section at the Attorney General's Office that advises CSSD and also represents CSSD in any court actions that they're involved in.
And do you have any general comments on the bill or the testimony you've heard so far?
Thank you. I would like to make one comment that under our current child support rule, 90.3, it has a provision, a couple of different formulas. We refer to the formula as a percentage approach if it's primary. So you can have primary, which means that one parent has the child for 70% of the time, or said another way, the non-custodial parent has the child for less than 110 overnight in an entire year. And then there's also, if it's shared, the formula will just look at that non-custodial parent's income, and then a percentage of their net income, which is after you take certain mandatory deductions like taxes out, it's a percentage of that parent's income. For example, it's 20% for one child. I would just comment that in that formula, although the rule only considers the non-custodial parent's income, one thing that's already factored into that formula is that the custodial parent will spend, will also spend their own money supporting that child that lives in their household. So although in the formula you don't consider the custodial parent's income, that's already factored into the formula. So you just look at the non-custodial parent's income. But when coming up with the percentages, it is assumed that the parent who takes care of that child and the child lives in their home will spend their own money supporting that child. And the second formula is the shared formula, which means that each parent has the child for more than 110 overnight. And when we get into the shared formula, it is basically more of an income shares approach, because when it's shared, you do look at both parents' income, and then you look at their income, and then you also consider the percentage of time each parent has that child. And then for the last formula, the divided custody, which each parent has primary custody of at least one child. And in that situation, it's basically almost a pure offset approach, where you figure out the formula with each parent having primary custody, and then you just offset the amounts that each parent would owe each other. So I just wanted to make that comment in general about the different formulas we have under the current rule and how that operates.
Thank you. And do you have any general comments on the relative fairness of either system as compared to the other?
Chairman, French. No, I do not. Certainly, the Department of Law, when we review this bill, we look at legal requirements that are necessary under federal law to ensure that CSSD can continue to receive federal funds to enforce and set child support. And we don't take any position on the fairness or policy on this bill.
Sure. Senator Coghill has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It looks like with the primary, shared, and divided, those are different tools. How nimble are those with regard to changing dynamics in the family?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, to answer your question, it's going to depend on the type of order, child support order. For example, the Director Melanie had mentioned if it's an administrative order, the agency can react quicker to changes. Certainly, one or both parents need to notify CSSD if there has been a change in the custody arrangement and request CSSD to make those appropriate changes. There's an administrative process through that, and there's some amount of flexibility under the CSSD regulations to make sure that the child support order does reflect the actual custody arrangement, assuming that the parents do advise the CSSD that there has been a change. The court process is a little bit different. At CSSD, they enforce their own administrative orders as well as court orders. If they're enforcing a court order and the parents do have a change of custody between the two of them, in those situations, the parents have to return to court to actually get their court order changed, and that's important for the parents to go through that process. And as part of changing their custody in the court, then the court would also change the support amount to match whatever the custody arrangement is. And CSSD does not get involved in court custody disputes. In those situations, the parents do need to go back to court to make that change. And then it just really will depend on the case on how quickly that will move through the court, whether that's a fairly simple case or whether there needs to be hearings. That's just going to really depend on the case.
So, Mr. Chairman, what I can take from this then is if this bill goes into law, that circumstance really doesn't change because you still are going to have to figure out how the shared income works under those dynamics, true?
Through the chair, yes, that would be correct. That this line of thought is going to change that because the parents would still need to go back to court to advise the court that custody had changed and for the court to issue a new custody order and then also issue a new support order that
also
changed. And through the chair, I would like to address one other comment.
Sure.
You had asked whether we had any, the Attorney General's office had any position on whether this new formula would be more fair. And we don't take a position on whether we think this would be more fair. But I would comment that I think certainly there's a perception that if you look at both parents' income, it's more fair. But whether the end result is actually more fair and is more fair to the child, which is important that the child be supported, you would actually have to look at the calculation really to see what the result is.
Sure. That's a good comment. Lastly, Ms. Steinberg, let me ask you about Sections 4 and 5 of the bill, the repeal of the court rule and the non-applicability of the two-thirds vote requirement. Do you have any view on that? Have you taken a look at the legal issues behind that approach?
Mr. Chairman, no, I have not specifically looked at that issue. I do know that, the current child support rule is really a substantive rule as opposed to most of your traditional court rules. So certainly it would be my understanding that those two sections are correct.
Very good. We'll just run that. We'll just do a little more checking on that. Senator Coghill, any questions?
It just seems odd to me that the Constitution says the legislature may change by two-thirds, and here we're going to relegate it to a majority vote. So it just seems odd to me. So I'll be looking forward to that answer.
We'll bear down on that as well. Thanks. Good hearing. Ms. Shockley, any wrap-up comments you want to make on the bill before we set it aside for the time being?
Yes, Dorothy Shockley, staff to Senator Kukesh. I just briefly went through the bill, but I could be more specific if you would like in some areas. But the other thing that I wanted to comment on is the review process that I went through in 2008. The process that I experienced in 2008, you know, when I found out, I asked the department or the court department, the division that was doing the review, how they were going to advertise and get input. And, of course, you know, they mentioned the LIOs and some papers. But I mentioned to the department that over 100 of the 100-plus communities that are in Senate District C, only one has an LIO. So I suggested, you know, doing advertisements by radio or, you know, newspapers, but only half of them get papers. So I'm not sure if they actually, you know, did the ads on the on the radios, you know, to let people know. But I encouraged other districts to get the word out, especially in rural Alaska. I did as well. I encouraged people to write and participate if they could by phone in the hearings. And, you know, we got copies of some letters that were written. And, of course, you know, I know that they compiled them all and made suggestions. But my understanding is, you know, once the committee, the review committee, you know, makes the recommendations and then they go to the Superior Court, then it's up to them to decide which recommendations they will, you know, make changes on. And just especially that one year, you know, even though there was many or some recommendations made, I think they only made two. And so, you know, and then, of course, at the end of the process, they held a statewide hearing for people to make comments. And I was shocked that, you know, I think it only lasted like 30 minutes, and only, I think, four or five people attended the statewide hearing. So that's why I asked, you know, how we can possibly make changes so that people whose lives are being affected by this law, this rule, can actually speak to someone and be heard. So, thank you very much.
Very good. Final comments?
Just a question. I first of all, I appreciate you bringing it forward, and I think public comment on this is important, so I applaud you for that. One of the things that may be helpful to us as we think this through and the committee grows in number is your thinking on the change in methodology. I think that would be very important. And then since the cost of this looks like it's going to mount higher, do we actually better put resources into some of the, the enforcement or things that we can do to help people who feel like they've been treated unfairly, including you know, some help to the court in that regard. So I'm looking for solutions here. If the calculation of the style gets too costly, but you still want to put it in statute, that might be one thing to look at as well. So just I'm throwing out ideas that that just kind of occur to me as I've listened to this.
Yes, Senator Coghlan, through the chair. Well, that was the other recommendation when we were first going to put it into statute. You know, when we first introduced the bill 3 years ago, we were just putting the rule into statute. But the other recommendation was to put it or to change the calculation to shared income. And I had Ledge Research do some research. And of the 50, but this was in 2005, 35 states used the shared income. And I know there's perception of it being fair, but I think in some cases it will be. I feel that, I can't say, because, you know, every situation is going to be different. And I did have Mr. Maloney do a calculation, because just for an example of how this would work. And I don't know if you got it in your packets or not, but
I don't recall seeing one.
I sent it to
to
your office.
Send it again. I'm not sure we did get it.
Yeah. But there is a he did send me an example.
Oh.
And you know, if there's a mom that made $1,000, and my question was, you know, if the mom makes $1,000 a month and has a child for 10 months, and the father makes $1,500 and has a child for 2 months per year, you know, how is that calculated? And it doesn't, she would have primary custody because she has a child more than 70% of the time. So that doesn't play into effect, or it doesn't change. So you have the, you know, the total amount is for the month of both parents is $2,500. And based on the child's age, you know, that also makes a difference. And so if the child is from 0 to 11, then the child support would be $526. And the dad's obligation, I mean, there's just all kinds of different calculations, but he would end up paying $315. And then if the child is over 12, then the child support goes up. So it'd be $650 a month, and the father would, because he, even though he has the child 2 months, I mean, he would still pay $390 a month. And then under court rule, it would just be the father's income, which is $1,500, and they would take 20% of that, and so he would pay $300 a month.
Mm. Yeah, make sure we get that. We'll take a look.
Okay.
Further questions? I don't see any. It's 3 o'clock anyway. Good hearing. I appreciate, again, I thank Senator Coggle for being here. Thank the presenters. With that, we're going to go ahead and adjourn.